welcome. It's Tuned to Yesterday, bringing you shows from radio's golden era. I'm your host, Mark Levenier, with you for this hour of science fiction. Later on, we'll hear Exploring Tomorrow with the story The Martian Queen. Right now, it's an episode of 2000+, from May 3rd, 1950, from the Mutual Broadcasting System, part of their Wednesday night lineup at 9 o'clock. Competing with ABC's Rogues Gallery, a detective show with Dick Powell, and the comedy The Harold Perry Show on CBS. This episode stars seasoned radio actors Louis Van Ruten and Lon Clark.
Transcribed. Send our imaginations forward into time, into the years beyond 2000 A.D. What strange adventures, what exciting things will we find in the world of tomorrow? 2000+. Today, an adventure of outer space, when the worlds met. The year 2000+20. At the giant spaceport in Washington, D.C., temporary capital of the Federated World Government, an enormous throng, tense with expectancy, jams every available inch of space surrounding the rocket landing field. All eyes strain upward into the clear blue sky. For today is the day, April 21st, 2000+20. And audio and televox networks of the world are at the rocket field to cover the epic event. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is the day we've all been waiting for. In a matter of minutes now, out of that brilliant blue sky will come a ship, a spaceship, carrying in its gleaming hold the first load of uranium taken from the pits of Luna, satellite of Earth. Since the beginning of time... Now, one moment, folks. There's a signal from the tower. This may be it. Take it away, Fred.
This is Fred Haskins reporting from the control tower. Our escort planes have been in contact with the spaceship from Luna for the past 12 minutes. They are now approaching the field from the northeast, and any moment now we can expect...
And there she is, the rocket ship Kronos, 17 hours out of Luna City. Her magnetium hull white hot from the friction of the atmosphere. Her jet brakes belching fire. She's right over the field now. She's coming down. Down! He's landed! Mark well this date, my friends. This is the dawn of the interplanetary age!
Luna City, Johnny Dixon.
Dixon, where you been? You're 3 minutes late.
Sorry, McCabe. All shipments as scheduled, everything routine.
Report noted. Check out.
Check out.
You know, Johnny...
What for?
Sometimes I think we're crazy. Spending our lives cooped up in this pressurized shell, breathing synthetic air, risking our necks every time we put on a space suit and go out into the cold, barren, pitted piece of green cheese. Huh? And for what?
Well, you're kidding, Paul. You know the answer. We're space happy. That's all that's wrong with us. Huh. We pulled every wire and frankly tore the World Federation apart getting this assignment on the moon. And we'll do it again when the first flight into deep space gets underway. Next month and next year, whenever they get through with their preparations.
Yeah, I guess that's it. But right now, Johnny, what I wouldn't give to see a tree again. And cornfields in Kansas.
Me, I want to hear a bird sing. And watch the lights go on in the skyscrapers along the waterfront. I want to dance with my girl and breathe in the sweet smell of violet. Boy, if I... What's that?
Huh?
That sound, that vibration. There, do you hear it?
Well, I'm not sure whether I heard or felt it, Johnny. Like a current of air passing by me.
Yeah, that's it. Some kind of pulsation. It's making my skin tingle.
Listen. Sounded different, didn't it?
Yeah, a different pitch.
The instruments are all steady. Nothing on the visiscreen.
The radar's negative.
What is it, Johnny?
Where's it from?
Not from Earth, I'll swear to that.
I got a crazy notion, Paul. A crazy notion that someone's trying to signal it.
You mean...
I don't know what I mean.
Maybe McCabe's right. Maybe I got a touch of...
Johnny, what is it?
Look, Paul. Look at the direction finder. It swung all the way around. Those sounds, those waves are coming from outer space. I've got to call...
Earth calling Luna City
to Earth. Go ahead, Earth. Go ahead, McCabe.
Nixon, what's going on up there? What's the idea of beaming out those hammy signals?
Signals?
Yeah, the harpy effect. The music of the sphere stuff. Giving the boys on the monitors down here the heebie-jeebies.
You got them too, McCabe? You picked them up on Earth?
Certainly. What's it all about?
The signals, if that's what they are coming from one definite spot in outer space.
Outer space?
That's what I said.
Johnny, get your space suit ready. Better have a conference about it.
But listen...
Have your men tune up rocket 307. Blast off at 0800. We'll be expecting you on Earth in the morning.
Days now we've been getting those signals, and not one of you geniuses has been able to decipher them.
Very well, Mr. McCabe, if you know of anyone who can do it better, then
you'd better... Take it easy, Professor Wolfson. You don't have to be so touchy. But 10 days. What do you say, Dr. Lee?
10 days or 10 years, it makes no difference. If those sounds or signals are code, it is in a language unknown to man.
You're sure of that?
We've consulted the foremost cryptographists of the world. We've tried every way to break the code.
What does that add up to?
That message, if it is a message, does not come from anywhere on Earth or from any man on Earth.
I told you, Chief. It's what I've been saying all along. Of course you can't decode those messages in any known language, living or dead, because they come from Mars.
Mars, that cannot possibly...
be. Yes, Mars. My directional finder on the moon indicated it, and McCabe's down here pinned it down. Look at the graph. I brought it.
Directional signals can be wrong.
Yes, sir, but get this. I've been timing those signals. They come at intervals of exactly 24 hours, 37 minutes, and 22 seconds.
The length of the day on Mars.
Yeah. And if we were trying to signal them, we'd do it, say, every night at 1800. That's what they're doing to us.
In that case, the next signal is due
in
at...
10 minutes and 13 seconds. And we'll be sitting here like lummoxes, feeling our scalps tingle while the message drifts past us.
Gentlemen, excuse, please. But it seems to me the message need not necessarily drift past us.
What do you mean?
By the message, I do not mean... the sounds or the words that are being transmitted. I refer to the thoughts themselves. The thoughts that perhaps are being transferred from the Martians to us.
Thought transference? That's telepathy.
We have discarded that word, Mr. Dixon. Too many charlatans use it. But we do know that there is extrasensory perception of thought impulses. Just as there are sound waves which your ear has learned to interpret... and light waves which your eye and brain transform into a picture. So there are thought waves, electrical impulses discharged by the brain, which vary with the particular thought.
An intriguing idea, Dr. Lee. If only we had some instrument that could pick up and sort out these impulses.
There is such an instrument, Professor Wolfson.
What?
I have been working on it for many years. It involves a scanning screen intercepting an electrified field.
Well, what are we waiting for?
You understand, the telepathetor has only been tested for short distances.
The signals are reaching us. That's the only important thing, isn't it? How soon can we...
The instrument is in the next room. I took the liberty of bringing it with me, hoping it might conceivably be of some use. This way, gentlemen.
Say, this little machine can take thoughts and turn them into words we can hear? English words?
Not only English, Mr. McKee. It will translate thought impulses into any language for which you set the dial. You think of something, Mr. Dixon. Now, listen. First, I set for French.
Et maintenant, les Chinois.
German.
Wonderful, these Chinesen.
And English.
Darn clever, these Chinese.
You must understand...
Oh, excuse me, Dr. Lee, but we'll have to postpone this. 15 seconds to go. Better set your dials for a remote pickup. Stand by, everyone.
Nothing. More power.
Well, it was a good try.
Wait. I've got that feeling again. My skin's beginning to crawl.
Yeah, mine too.
Oh, no, it's just your imagination.
Quiet! They are coming through now.
Planet 4. Greeting, Planet 3.
Infinite Mars.
The fourth planet from the sun. greeting planet 3. Planet 4 calling planet 3. We are trying to reach you, planet 3. If you receive our signal, respond. If you receive our signal, respond. We will communicate again.
Life on Mars. This week, ladies and gentlemen, the question that has bedeviled mankind ever since the day he first stood erect and gazed into the heavens has been answered. There is life on Mars, intelligent, articulate life. The country, the world, tonight seethes with excitement. Has Mars received our response? Has our telepathator succeeded in projecting as thoughts the messages spoken into it by human beings? Or can it merely receive the thoughts?
I'll never get enough of it.
Oh, it's lovely, Johnny. And look, there's a moon out tonight.
Moon? Oh, please. You know, it's hard to believe that back in 1950, people could still get romantic over that cold, dead, pockmarked heavenly yo-yo.
Oh,
now, that red star up there, Mars, that's a different proposition. It's alive. There are living beings up there.
Johnny, it's staggering. It's beyond imagination. It's...
Rubbish. Why shouldn't there be life up there?
They're so advanced. Spaceships and interplanetary signals.
Maybe you've got a point at that. We thought we were so smart because we reached the moon. Our spaceships aren't developed enough yet to get to Mars.
It's just as well.
What?
Because you would want to be the first to go.
Wouldn't you like that? I'd be quite a hero. You could point at my picture and say, hey, that's my guy.
You're my guy anyway, Johnny.
Sure, Terry. But don't worry, honey. I won't be seeing any Martians for a long time.
All personnel, stand by. Stand by for XM signal.
That'll be Mars. Hop to it, Johnny.
Telepathator setting, 212 degrees, 18 seconds. Frequency, 600,000.
Got that, Johnny?
Check.
Planet 4 calling Planet 3. Planet 4 calling Planet 3. We greet you in peace. Your response received.
We got through it.
The time has come. At this moment, which marks the beginning of the great interstellar age between worlds, it is fitting that there be between us a meeting of minds. Therefore, we are sending a ship to visit your planet.
No, it can't be.
The ship will depart tonight and enter your magnetic field in 7 of our days. Have landing instructions ready. We come in peace. We come in peace.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Matt Wilson bringing you a report of the emergency session of the Federated World Government. Never has an assembly meeting taken place in such an atmosphere of excitement, panic, and recrimination. And here on the floor of the Assembly Chamber,
we've enough
all the emotions aroused by the stunning message from Mars have been boiling and clashing all day.
I rise for a point of information. As civilian head of the world military government, I want to know why those Martians have beaten us to the draw.
Gentlemen, gentlemen. If the decision we are to make is to be a wise one, we must lay aside passions and fears and consider the question calmly. The Martians are coming, and we must receive them either with friendship or hostility.
Drive them off! Blast them out of the sky!
But that may not be as simple as it sounds. Remember, my friends, these Martians are advanced scientifically, perhaps far beyond us. They have conquered deep space. They can transmit thought waves. They may have weapons, beside which our nuclear bombs are as toy pistols.
Dr. Lee is right, gentlemen. We don't dare fight them off. The risk is too great.
They come in peace. They've said so over and over again. Let us so receive them.
Very well, very well. If such is the will of his body, let them come in peace. But as civilian head of the world military government, I assure you all, we will not be found napping.
Earth calling Martian interstellar ship. Earth calling Martian interstellar ship. Here are the landing instructions of the Federated World Government. 3 Earth days from this hour, which will be the 6th Martian day of your flight through space, you will be met by an escort of 20 rocket ships. We will greet you in the name of peace. The 20 rocket ships will escort you.
Instructions to Commission of Defense. All escort rocket ships assigned to accompany Martian spaceship will carry the following armaments: death fog sprays, magnetic disintegrators, atomic missiles class B. All weapons shall be on the...
And upon your entry into the Earth's atmosphere, you will circle our globe once and then make landing at our spaceport at Los Alamos, New Mexico, which will be ready to receive you.
The spaceport of Los Alamos shall be mined to a depth of 50 feet with tritonium landmines. The field shall be encircled with radioactive flamethrowers and a reserve force.
From the landing field, you will be conducted to the seat of the world government at Washington, D.C., where you will be received and housed in suitable accommodations. We will welcome you in peace. Check out.
We will welcome you in peace. We hope.
Accommodations. Trust McCabe to hand me a crackpot assignment like this.
Johnny, you're the big space man. You're supposed to know by instinct what's suitable accommodation for a Martian.
Don't be silly, Terry. I haven't the slightest notion in the world what they'll look like except some crazy ideas I picked up from science fiction. I don't know why.
All right. That's why we're here. The head of our anthropology section has more ideas than any science fiction writer you've ever read. Now, here we are.
Terry, come in.
Hello, Professor. This is Mr. Dixon, the young man I told you about.
I know Mr. Dixon.
Professor, I've got a problem.
Terry and I have discussed the problem. It is my theory that the Martians will, in most important respects, have the characteristics of the Earthman.
Oh, what's the basis of your theory, Professor?
It's very simple. The accomplishments of the Martians parallel our own. Only a being with opposable thumbs can fashion the intricate devices necessary for spaceships. Only a being with a nervous system like our own could master communication. Only a creature with a brain like ours could dream of peace.
Makes sense, Professor.
That's one side of it, Johnny. A lot of other anthropologists think differently.
That is so.
They feel that the Martians living on a dry planet with little vegetation and very little water will be creatures that crawl on the ground like our insects, enlarged a few thousand times. They may look like enormous ants with oversized antennae.
I give up. With 48 hours left, I can't prepare accommodations for every conceivable form of life. I'll just have to improvise after they get here. I just hope they don't get too sick when they first look at us.
Reporting from the spaceport at Los Alamos. A tremendous crowd is gathered here. We're awaiting the appearance of the spaceship from Mars, which is being escorted by 20 rocket ships from the rendezvous near the moon. According to reports, all's gone well so far. The Martian ship... Now, one moment, please. An audiobox announcement is going to be made to the people assembled.
Your attention, please. The ship from Mars and its escorts will be seen any moment from the east.
You heard that. Any moment, the ship from Mars and... What? There they are! They're coming in! I'll answer the rocket ship first! And now, the ship from Mars. The Martian ship is idling over the field now, casting a huge shadow over the landscape. It's an awe-inspiring spectacle. The ship is tremendous, 18 to 20 stories in height, several city blocks long, and its large windows are fashioned of some kind of transparent metal.
Civilian commander to Special Defense Patrol. Man battle stations.
Our technical experts are staring at the craft in open-mouthed wonder. Mr. McCabe, what is your reaction?
I am dumbfounded. The ship doesn't seem to operate on a rocket principle. There's no belching fire, no clouds of smoke. I keep wondering what kind of fuel they use, what principles of propulsion, what metal.
Thank you, sir. The ship is almost touching the ground now, and the crowd is getting uneasy. Why, they're falling back, as though there was something. I see it now. It's a blue haze misting about the Martian ship, forming a 20-foot blanket of whatever it is.
Commander, Defense Patrol, 0 hour. Reorient all weapons. Remove safety controls. Stand by to fire.
The Secretary of the World Federation is going to speak.
As your great ship settles on our soil, we salute you, the emissaries of space. We wait eagerly for your appearance.
Now, the blue mist has completely vanished. All eyes are on the ship, waiting for the first Martian to appear. There is no sign of activity yet.
Will you respond to our greetings, Martians? Will you make your presence known?
Nothing stirring. No gangplank lowered. No sign of life. Perhaps they were not prepared for atmospheric conditions here. Perhaps on the very brink of success, death has struck within that awe-inspiring vessel. Wait, it looks like... Yes, it's moving. A tremendous section of the ship's prow is opening out in front. Like a gigantic tongue, it thrusts forward and drops to earth, forming a great ramp from the ship to our soil. And now it's down, and the surface of the ramp is like nothing ever seen on this earth. A shimmering, impalpable iridescence, unbelievably radiant and beautiful. The throng of spectators are silent, motionless, scarcely breathing, waiting to see the first Martian emerge. And still, nothing. No one, no thing comes down the ramp. There is nothing but silence. Listen, that must be the Martian communication vibrations we were told about. Then men on the field are operating the receiving device.
Earthmen, we ask that you send one representative to board our craft. We assure his safety.
Gentlemen, there is no cause for alarm.
I think there is. They want a hostage or a specimen to take back with them.
There's no time for wrangling. They're waiting for a decision.
Mr. Secretary.
Yes, Mr. McCabe.
If it's all right with the committee, I'd like to go aboard. Technical information, sir.
No.
Quiet, Johnny.
This is my dish, McCabe. I was slated for the space run to Mars, remember? You're not doing me out of this. Besides, you're too valuable to waste. Mr. Secretary, tell them I'm coming aboard.
Men of Mars, we comply with your request. Our representative is about to board your ship.
Get ready, Johnny Dixon. This is it. Take a good long look at the sun in the sky. Take a deep breath of the Earth's good air. You may never get another after you meet whatever is waiting at the end of this long ramp. The ramp. Pulling me forward like a conveyor belt. It's beginning to rise into the air. Get a move on, Johnny. Get into that ship. Get into that ship fast. Make it. Locked in. No. There's no one here. Nothing except that dancing light. I'll follow it.
By four solid walls.
Follow the light, Earthman. The walls will not impede you.
Molecular reorientation? Changing the density of solid matter at will?
We achieved that 10,000 cycles ago, Earthman.
Where are you, man of Mars? This room is flooded with light, but I see no one.
We are not ready to reveal ourselves.
The people of Earth are waiting to see you, to welcome you. There is nothing to fear.
We are not afraid. Did Dixon.
You know my name.
We know many things. That is why we are sad, filled with revulsion.
I don't understand. What do you mean?
Through the dark spaceways, we came to you in peace. You said to us, come in peace. But the escorts you sent to honor us were armed for destruction. The very ground on which we now rest seeds with radioactive potential.
Wait! You misunderstood us. These weapons are for defense against you, not attack.
Many cycles ago, we of Mars learned, as you Earthmen will someday learn, that wars are fought, men are slaughtered, civilizations wiped out by those who attack with weapons of defense.
But our world is at peace now.
Your peace is not peace. It is a thin cloak which covers the hates and fears and savagery of primitive beings. Observe, Dixon. On this large visit screen, we have for hours been viewing your people in many parts of your Earth. Watch.
The Senator.
Listen.
I warned you it was a trap. We'll never again see Dixon alive. I told you not to trust foreigners. Just give me the word and I'll blast them all in the kingdom come.
You must not be deceived. He's only one man. The rest of us are different.
Are you? Look at this from another part of your civilized Earth.
You have been a traitor to our party. You've been guilty of bourgeois thinking. You have sold us out to the enemies of our people. You will pay the penalty. But first you will confess. Confess!
That's a backward part of our planet. It's not fair to judge by them.
Then we reveal a more civilized area. The country of your birth, Dixon.
No, no, no!
The law became time too good for him. Hang him, I say, hang him! The rope! String him up in the highest tree in the square! Lynch him! Lynch him! Lynch him!
Now you know why we shall not reveal ourselves to you. If you are like this to these of your own kind, what will you think? What will you do when you see us, strange as we are?
Don't go. We know you may be different from us, but we can all meet in peace.
Earthman, peace must be achieved through toil and sacrifice of those few among you who understand its meaning. It may take many cycles, but in the end, the day will arrive. Then, and then only, we will return. Go back to your people, man of Earth, and give them the message from Mars.
Next week, another exciting drama on 2000 Plus, The Silent Noise. In the year 2000 Plus 20, an important man is murdered. How will the police of the future track down a killer? And what new methods of assault will the criminals of tomorrow use? Listen next week, and you'll find out. 2000 Plus is produced by Sherman H. Dreyer and Robert Winolson. In today's story, Ken Williams played Johnny, Louis Van Ruten played the voice of Mars, Lon Clark played McCabe, Frank Behrens was the Senator, Amzie Strickland was Terry, Sanford Bickert was Paul, and Gilbert Mack was Dr. Lee. The orchestra was conducted by Emerson Buckley, music composed by Elliot Jacoby. Script by Judith and David Bublik. Sound by Walt Shaver and Al April. Engineer Bob Albrecht. And your announcer, Ken Marvin.
This program was transcribed.
This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
Plus, on Tuned to Yesterday, a Mutual Broadcasting System episode from May 3rd, 1950.
It's an hour of science fiction on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levinier. Both programs we're hearing are from the Mutual Broadcasting System, a network not necessarily known for their science fiction efforts. NBC really took the cake on that front with Dimension X and X-1 back-to-back and staples of radio listening in the 1950s. But a show that nearly outlived X-1 was Exploring Tomorrow. From April 2nd, 1958, we'll hear host John Campbell Jr. bring us into this broadcast called Sound Decision or The Martian Queen. And according to my research, there are actually three different authors rumored to have written the story: Paul Anderson, Robert Silverberg, or Randall Garrett. You decide next with this episode directed by Sanford Marshall. It's Exploring Tomorrow.
Let's consider the proposition that interplanetary spaceflight has become a commercial proposition. There are regular liners running between the planets. And the Martian Queen, we'll say, is such a liner, a spaceship making a short-run orbit from Mars to Earth. This time, she's carrying 150 passengers and a crew of 30 or so. She's made a long, uneventful trip from space, and now she's approaching the last leg of her voyage, the deceleration for landing.
Your attention, please. Throughout the trip, artificial gravity has been maintained by spin around the long axis of the ship. In 3 minutes, the gyros will begin to slow the spin. We have to stop the rotation around the axis of the ship in order to apply thrust along it. Please get into your bunks and fasten your safety belts.
At the appointed time, the gyros cut in, slowing the spin on the ship. When the rotation had stopped, the skipper of the Martian Queen and his navigator were ready to begin the actual landing.
How's our course, Willie?
Dead on, Captain Daring. We're approaching Earth a little over 60 miles per second.
I hate to land at this speed. How much time do we have?
About 15 seconds. The rocket tubes are aligned properly with respect to Earth. The timer is set. Ready?
Yep. Strapped in and ready. Keep her on automatic till the last 5,000 feet. I'll bring her down from there manually.
Right, sir. There she goes.
Engine room.
Get engineering on the intercom. We're out of control. We're dropping straight toward Earth.
The Martian Queen had been heading towards White Sands spaceport, and as a matter of course, the radar teams at White Sands had been alerted for the landing. They had the ship pinpointed in their screens, and when the Martian Queen stopped decelerating, they knew there was something wrong. The major in charge of Control Tower 1 put in a fast emergency call to the commanding officer's White Sands spaceport.
General Stanley speaking. What's that, Major? The Martian Queen. Where? Yes, I understand. All right, get all data you can on her now. Keep the radar tracking as long as possible and try to compute an orbit. I want to know where she's going to hit. And get a tight beam communications line to that ship. I want to speak to Captain Deering personally. Yes, Major, I'll be right over. Sergeant, get my jeep out in front fast. We're going to Control Tower 1. I'll be ready to gun it. This is a Class AAA emergency. Major, have you made tight beam connections with the Martian Queen?
Yes, sir.
Good. Now, I'll take the microphone. Hello, Captain Deering. This is General Stanley at White Sands. Can you hear me?
This is Deering. You're coming in fine, General.
What the devil happened up there?
Explosion in the engine room. Don't know what caused it. Four men dead and the rocket tubes are gone.
What about the main converter?
Almost completely gone. Splintered and blew into fragments when it went. There's plenty of heat and radiation. The engine crew must have died almost instantly.
Well, what about these secondary converters?
Nothing left of them but molten metal and slag.
Then you've got no way to slow down the ship or change its course?
No way whatever, General. Our only hope is that we don't hit Earth. If we are on a collision course, we're finished.
I know. Let's hope you go on past Earth without hitting it. Now, we have a radar fix on you, but it isn't accurate at this distance. Now, get your navigator busy. Now, we want your coordinates and velocity as close as you can figure them. Oh, keep this line open. I'll call you as soon as I can get more information.
Right. I'll get Blevin busy on those figures. Over.
Oh, Major.
Yes, sir.
Keep that line open no matter what happens. As soon as Captain Deering gives you those figures, have them coded and put through the big computer. Try to get a closer radar fix and put that data through the computer, too. I want an orbit on the Martian Queen that's as close as skin. You got it?
Yes, sir. Good. And keep this whole thing quiet. Nobody is to know that the Martian Queen is in trouble till I've notified the Secretary of Special Affairs in Washington. Meanwhile, I have to use your phone. Operator, this is Major General Stanley. I want to put in a person-to-person emergency call to the Secretary of Spatial Affairs, Washington, D.C. Call me back as soon as he's on the line. There are lives at stake. Hello, Experimental Station. General Stanley here. Now, let me talk to Colonel Arthmore. I don't care what he's doing. Get him on the phone. Colonel Arthmore, Stanley. What's the top acceleration of that new experimental job? That's right, the XV-19. Good. I want you to have it loaded, primed, and ready to go within 10 minutes. Emergency. I'll say it's an emergency. I want you to move faster than you've ever moved before. I want the XV-19 rocket out on the launching pad and ready within 10 minutes. Now, that's an order. And keep this under your hat. If a word of this leaks out or if that ship isn't ready to go on time, I'll see to it that you never wear those birds on your shoulder again. Is that clear? Good. Keep your line open for further orders.
Miles per second isn't terribly fast as far as celestial objects are concerned. But 60 miles per second is 216,000 miles per hour. And when the Martian Queen had had her accident, she was already close in to Earth. Something had to be done within the next 25 minutes. But what can be done in only 25 minutes?
Captain, I just got word from First Officer Haggerty there's trouble. Some of the passengers are getting space sick from being in free fall. They're wondering why the ship isn't decelerating.
Just have to take it a while longer. Did you get those figures relayed down to General Stanley?
Yes, sir. He said to hold on and give us the data as soon as possible. But the passengers...
I know. What did you want me to do? Tell him that the Martian Queen might be headed for the biggest, most spectacular crack-up in history? That'd be real smart, wouldn't it?
Well, I didn't mean it that way, Skipper. I was...
Take the radio phone. That's White Sands again. Deering here.
Deering, this is Stanley. How's everything?
The same as ever. No propulsion, no escape. How does our orbit look?
We have your coordinates down over here. We know within a mile or two where you'll hit.
Then we will hit Earth. Well, that does it, doesn't it?
I'm afraid so. If nothing happens between now and then, you're going to get a hot dunk in the ocean.
I see. Where will we hit?
Give or take a mile or so, or you'll hit Long Island Sound, about 10 miles south of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Well, we... You do what has to be done, General. You can depend on me for my end of it.
I knew I could. Well, I'll let you know how things work out.
I'll be waiting.
The seconds tick by, and every second that passes brings the Martian Queen 60 miles closer to Earth. At that speed, it doesn't take long to move a few thousand miles. The Martian Queen was heading toward death at 3,600 miles a minute.
Captain Deering, this is Stanley again. Colonel Arthmore just phoned. We're sending up the XV-19, a super-fast high-acceleration rocket. It's the only thing that can possibly reach you in time, and even so, it'll be a close thing. Meanwhile, I'm trying to get in touch with the Secretary of Spatial Affairs, but he's out of his office right now. I'll let you know when to expect the rocket.
All right, General. We'll be ready. Over.
Over.
Captain, I just came from the dining hall. Some of the passengers got out of their bunks and looked out the big viewport. And then they could see Earth, and they could see we're falling toward it. One of them started fighting with First Officer Haggerty, and the thing has ended up in a riot.
The crazy fools, this is no time to be fighting. Can't the crew do anything?
That triangle, it's pretty rough.
Hey, give me that microphone. Your attention, please. This is Captain Deering. Now, please, your attention. There has been an accident. The drive engines of the ship have been disabled and we're in a free fall orbit. However, there is no reason to become panicky. We are in contact with White Sands Spaceport, and we've been notified that everything is under control. Now, some of you have been worried by the sight of Earth through the viewport, but I assure you we are in no danger of striking Earth. I repeat, the Martian Queen absolutely will not strike Earth. I'm well aware that this gravity-less condition is uncomfortable to many of you, but please have patience. It will only last for a few more minutes. I suggest that all of you return to your cabins and strap yourselves in. If acceleration were to return suddenly, anyone not strapped down might be seriously hurt. Please return to your cabins. Thank you.
That'll help some. Blevin, you go down and talk to them. Give them the same sort of information I gave them. And, Blevin...
Yes, sir?
Isn't one of the passengers a minister?
Reverend James Taylor, I think his name is. He was a missionary on Mars.
Yeah, well, get him to help you. Sometimes people will listen to a clergyman when they won't pay attention to a space officer.
Right, sir. I'll do what I can.
Just a minute. That's Stanley. Yes, Deering here.
Deering. The XV-19 is on the launching pad now, loaded and ready to go. I haven't been able to get hold of the Secretary of Spatial Affairs yet, but there isn't time to wait. Oh, I just got the signal, Deering. The XV-19 has left the launching pad. It will be up to you to guide it into the Martian Queen. Good luck, Deering.
Thanks. But you'll need the good luck more than I will. So, good luck and goodbye. Okay, Blevin. Go down and give them a speech.
This is Major General Stanley at White Sands Spaceport. I have been trying to get the Secretary of Spatial Affairs person-to-person Washington, D.C. It has been 20 minutes now.
Wait.
He's on the line. All right. Oh, hello, Mr. Secretary.
Hello, General. I got to my office as soon as I heard. I've read the teletype report that you sent to my office. Is the Martian Queen definitely going to land in Long Island Sound?
If it isn't stopped, yes.
Well, is there any way at all of getting the drive going again?
No, sir. Captain Deering stated flatly that the main converter and the secondaries are absolutely and completely ruined. It would take weeks to repair them. We only have minutes.
Then we'll have to send up a rescue ship.
That's impossible, sir. A rescue ship would never make it in time. It would have to accelerate to take off, decelerate to match the Martian Queen's velocity, and then accelerate to keep from hitting Earth along with the Queen. All in all, it would take more than an hour, using every bit of acceleration a human being could stand.
There's absolutely no way we can save them.
None whatever, sir. There just isn't time.
Well, we're just lucky this time, I suppose.
Lucky? What do you mean?
Well, it could have been worse. What if it landed in a populated area like New York City instead of Long Island Sound?
You don't understand, Mr. Secretary. It isn't the Long Island Sound we have to worry about. It's the spaceship sound.
What do you mean?
Just what I said. It doesn't matter whether the Martian Queen hits Long Island Sound or New York City itself. The results will be almost the same. It's the sound waves, the noise that will do the damage.
I don't quite understand.
You know what happens when a supersonic jet plane flies too low over a city, don't you? At 1,500 miles an hour, the shock wave from a jet plane can break windows from miles around. What do you think will happen when that spaceship comes in at 216,000 miles an hour? It will flatten every structure within a 50-mile radius. If that ship hits Long Island Sound, New York City will be toppling in ruins before it ever arrives. From Newark, New Jersey to Hartford, Connecticut, that shock wave will knock over everything standing.
Can we evacuate the area?
In a few minutes? Well, hardly.
And what do you suggest, General?
There's only one thing we can possibly do. Send up a rocket with an atomic bomb in it and blow that ship into gas before it hits.
Are you crazy, General? Blow up 180 innocent people? I can't permit that. It's murder.
Murder? Is it murder to kill people who are already doomed? Is it murder to save the lives of 20 million people?
There must be another way. General, I order you to send up a rescue ship immediately.
Listen, you blockhead. Do you understand that it is impossible to send up a rescue ship? Do you understand that I can't pull miracles out of a hat? We could no more get a rescue ship up there in time than we could catch the Martian Queen with our bare hands.
You can't talk to me that way, General.
I'm sorry. I'm simply trying to get you to understand there's only one way out. Those people in that spaceship are going to die, no matter what we do. It would be better if they died without taking a few million more people with them.
There must be some other way.
Do you have any suggestions?
Well, no.
Exactly.
But...
there isn't any other way. Now, do I have your permission to send up that bomb?
No. We've got to think of something else.
It's no use. I just looked at the clock, Mr. Secretary. It's too late to do anything at all now. Even if you ordered it, a rocket bomb leaving this instant would be too late.
General, you have to do something. All those people...
Oh, don't worry, Mr. Secretary. The Martian Queen won't hit the Earth. There won't be any crash. I sent up an XV-19 rocket under robot control several minutes ago. It was loaded with a thermonuclear warhead. I would have liked to have had your permission, but there simply was no time.
You've already blown it up?
That's right. I did it with Captain Deering's cooperation, of course. He knew it was the only way to prevent the destruction of 20 million people. So he guided the missile into his own ship. The Martian Queen was vaporized over a minute ago.
I presume you know what this means, General?
I know what it means. I'll have to be court-martialed because most people won't understand why I did it any more than you did. Even if I get out of it with a whole skin, I lose everything I've ever worked for. But that's a small matter compared with the satisfaction of knowing that I saved the lives of 20 million human beings. Maybe those people will understand why Captain Deering and I did what we did. And they're the ones who count.
Exploring Tomorrow on Tuned to Yesterday with the story The Martian Queen from April 2nd, 1958. The host of the program was John Campbell, Jr., known as the father of science fiction editors. And here are some of his thoughts on the world of sci-fi as recorded in a rare interview in the Biography and Sound program from December 4th, 1956, their episode called Ticket to the Moon.
A woman scorned hath no fury like two or more science fiction editors arguing the difficult definition... just what is science fiction?
The essential difference between science fiction and fantasy, though they're both imaginative literatures, is that in science fiction, we are trying to study the problem of, oh, you might call it disciplined imagination.
John Campbell of Astounding.
In fantasy, anything that makes an amusing story is allowable. The law of gravity, for instance, can be violated at will in fantasy. In science fiction, you can have an anti-gravity device. But this is acknowledging that the law of gravity exists and making specific provision to overcome it in a known, described, or at least implied scientific manner. The airplane does not violate the law of gravity. It uses it. In fantasy, the witch's broom violates the law of gravity.
It has been suggested that perhaps it is easier to speculate on rocket travel to the moon than to suggest a solution to the problem Dr. Asimov raises, that is, parking. However, the science fiction aficionado holds that there is a place in our culture for speculation on both topics. In fact, this matter of speculation is at the core of it all. Perhaps this serious self-examination is one of the most striking characteristics of science fiction, as if the writers and readers felt the continual urge to recline on the loneliest couch of self-analysis and contemplate their novelettes. Certainly one can't find a similar habit of cerebration in, say, Shadow magazine or True Love Stories. No editor of a Western magazine has arrived at as thoughtful a self-picture as Well, for example, editor Campbell of Astounding.
Our language, you might say our language lacks a word. We have the word impossible, but we need to differentiate between two sorts of things. The impossible is that which, by definition, can never be done. We need another word, unpossible, that which can't be done just yet. At the present time, it is impossible to buy a ticket to Mars. That does not mean that it is impossible. Eventually, that can be done. Science fiction tries to differentiate between the impossible and the impossible, to try to determine what can be done and speculate about it.
Thoughts and definitions on science fiction from John Campbell, Jr., host of our last broadcast of Exploring Tomorrow, and a rare interview from December of 1956. That brings to a close this hour of science fiction on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great shows from radio's golden age. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levillier. Thanks for tuning in.